sitting here with the host of our new podcast. He's a subject matter expert, tying aficionado, feather merchant, streamer Jesus, Kelly Gallup.
That's it. That's it. For those of you who don't know, the guy asking the question is Braden Anderson, a.k.a. Camera Guy. Braden is also a incredible angler. Do you not tie, do you?
Not really.
Shitty tire.
Shitty tire.
But incredible casting instructor and angler, and has been my camera guy full-time for over a year. So he's the guy asking the questions.
I think before we jump into it, we don't have a working name yet for the show, so we'd love to hear your recommendations in the comments, given who our subject matter expert is. The names we've come up with so far have been not necessarily YouTube appropriate. So if you've got some recommendations, we'd love to hear them. Slide-in podcast is a little bit mundane for our liking. So
they might fire me too, then we couldn't do it here.
Yeah, it'd be trouble.
That would be a problem.
All right, anything else before we jump in?
Negative.
So the first thing I kind of wanted to discuss was the project we've been working on, which was the hunt for the 30. Diving in there, let's just talk about how difficult it is to actually target a 30-inch fish, let alone catch one.
Oh, I mean, truly white whale talk. I mean, you know, you people talk about a lot of stuff like this, like it's just a, and first of all, we're talking wild fish. I mean, I watch a lot of these southern planted places where I saw one last night on Facebook where it said a great, great weekend or something. And I think there was a gal and a guy and they had, I don't know, probably 6 browns and rainbows combined over 30. I was like, whoa. So now you start talking wild fish in wild water, public water. Says the rest of it's all bullshit. Doesn't mean, you know, catching a stocker popper doesn't mean shit. So
pellet pig.
Yeah, whatever. They just don't count. But the truly to get a 30, and I got thinking about Andy Mill when we did the podcast with him and Nikki. Asked me how many 30 inches I'd caught, and he said hundreds, and I'm like, holy shit. Not even in my dreams, not even in my ego could I pretend that. And he said 100. I said, yeah, maybe. And I was still kidding. I mean, I think in reality, truly, like, because you can't count brown or rainbows. You can only count brown trout, and you can't count going to some semi-wild. I mean, you know, certain places. But even if you go to Iceland, or you're going to go to, you know, South Island or something like that, to legitimately hit a 3-0 is so freaking, it is hen's teeth rare, man. It is like, doesn't freaking happen. I grew up in the Great Lakes, and I've gotten maybe, and I think, I hope that didn't, in the milk, in the podcast, I haven't sat down and watched all of it thoroughly, but he said 100. I said, yeah, maybe. And I was trying to be funny, but I don't think in a true hunt for a 30-inch brown or rainbow wild, I think if you could, and this is fly, not gear and bait, and precluding no migratory, no, you can't say migratory, but, you know, bed rapers, guys who go in and bed rape them, and we're talking daytime, there's a lot of things that come into it. Dropping out of the, going into pure night fishing, that pretty much doubles or maybe quadruples your ability to get one. But I count my night hexes, which really was less than 3 over 30 in my life. And I don't think anyone on the planet fished hexes more than I did. Pretty bold statement, but I did 63 straight nights one year, missed a night, and did 17 more nights. And we would fish hexes, and you have to fish multiple drainages to do that, because they're only 10 days, 2 weeks on a regular river, and then you got to move someplace to find them. And then we'd mouse on the way out. And so, you know, you're really giving yourself that nocturnal, because that's when they really eat. But if you go daytime and you go wild rivers, it's very conceivable you go your lifetime and never see one.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, you might pretend that that 26 came up and whopped you, comes 30, but you think of all the time I spend on the white. I mean, I started fishing that in the 80s, early 80s, and a lot, all through 90s and 2000s up until COVID. To see, I mean, hook, yes, but to put it, to put all the pieces of the puzzle together and put them back in there, I mean, a person could truly go a lifetime and never have it happen. Not even, I mean, just doesn't happen. And so, and you're talking about people like, you know, me and other Johnny and you and other people who, and they're targeting these fish, right? Trying to do it. And I've said it in 100 seminars. People tell me that I catch those fish all the time, and it's such a crock of shit. Nobody does it all the time. And the only people that catch them all the time are flat out lying. I don't give a shit who they are. If you're a fly guy, and they're, those fish suddenly, the 30 on a tape suddenly is 25, 6, and you know, I do it all the time. I see people's pictures all the time, and I see that 3-0 word, and I'm like, yeah.
Give them the push.
Yeah. You know, how do you, how many more ways can you do that and make it happen? And so, I mean, to me, to see a 30 a year would be just spectacular.
Well, I mean, that's what I joke about with the shop guys a lot. It's like, I'm curious if my flies have ever been past a 30-inch fish. I've never caught one. You know, I on our hunt for a 30 the day where you were swapping boats, I cracked a 28.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I'm not sure my flies have been past one.
And that's huge.
It's kind of a daunting thought, you know? Like, yeah, it was a huge fish. I was very happy with it.
I say that in the seminars frequently, that if you've never caught a... I mean, even if you want to just... The 30 is a magic number. That is like... That's like, you know, a 60-inch muskie or a 190 whitetail or a 390 elk or whatever you want to play the game on, a 10-pound bass. I mean, they're numbers that fly out in the world, but there's no reality to it. And I say in the seminar all the time, if you've not caught, and we can just bring it down to a reality check, say a 25, which is not that uncommon, but still a magnificent fish. I mean, unbelievable fish. I remember when you said you got a 20. I don't know what happened. If we got so good that 20 is no longer a, like, giant freaking fish, right? It's like 20 used to be really, and I still, a 20 still gets my adrenaline running. I don't understand how people play it down. So now it's like 2-footers are common. Shit, that is such a crock of shit. It is so uncommon to get a wild 2-footer. So if you want to just play that 25, or on my fly rod, I think I have it still over there. My first streamer rod that I ever developed for Powell, it had 3 lines on it. It said 20, cute, 24, nice, and 27 was real. And I taped the markings on my rod, and the words were written on them. And so anything over 27, let's play that game for a while, because 30 is almost an unobtainable wild fish, non-spawner, on a bed type thing. And so, but I said it, and I said it, and what I was getting at was in the seminars, I always talk about how we... I say to people, if you've caught a lot of these, you're probably in the wrong seminar, because you'd probably be teaching it, because catching a lot of them is pretty incredible. But I say it's probably not the fact that your fly wasn't seen by it, or there wasn't, your fly was wrong. It was that the fish didn't see it, like you just said. You wonder if you, I know yours has been seen by them because I know where you fish. But A, there's limited numbers of them, obviously. But and when I get to that, I say it's probably not your fly, as much as I like people who think their fly is super important. But I think there is a lot of value to the fly. But it's more the fact that your fly wasn't seen by a fish.
Right.
Your fly was over in the same shit that everybody else throws at in the same fast water, blah, blah, blah. Never where the fish is programmed to sit and rest and triggered that response to the fish. So, and I said it, and I've done thousands of seminars, and I'm just like, I said, if you can go fish a river and you fish it 10 times and you fish the same goddamn bank every time you go and you still never seen a 2-footer, what the hell are you doing here? Why? How many times you got to hit yourself in the face with a hammer before you say, God, that hurts. Don't go there. Go try. I know I've said it. You've been in the seminars. I've said it to a million times. Maybe just take a day and say, I'll fish every side that I've never fished before. I'm going to fish some really shitty looking water.
Yeah.
Just really dog shit. I would never throw over here. And you know what might happen? That fly might be seen by the 30.
I mean, I think you're hitting on something really important. And it's kind of the idea of, the definition of insanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think anglers fall into complacency. And especially like, you know, yourself, myself, most of the people we're around up here are fishing 100 days a year, you know, somewhere around that. They're fishing a lot. They have a lot of opportunities. So they don't necessarily care about putting fish in the net. So they're more willing to experiment with fishing the other side of the river, fishing what you don't mm-hmm. traditionally see as trouty water. So I think that's important for anglers to try to kind of break out of their habits. I mean, if it's not working, do something different, right?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, no matter what you do. I mean, you know, I make a lot of metaphors here I've used over the years, but for white tails or for whatever it is that you do, and if you just always go to the same, I hunt this spot, right? It's deer season here and elk season, right? I go here, and you've never seen a real big animal, but you just keep going there because it's very comfortable.
Right. It's an easy walk in from the road or whatever.
Yeah, it's an easy walk in. Or like my cousin Billy, his son Hunter, you know Hunter, well, you know both of them well. You know, Hunter built Billy a great blind. I said, well, I hope this is where they are because he'll never leave it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It is pretty suave. but I mean, it's the same thing. You know, you get very comfortable, or maybe, you know, one of the big things that draws anglers away from where they should be fishing, just like night fishing, it's no different. Back in the day, I mean, night fishing's spooky. You know, you're out there in swamps and you're fishing where shit's making noises and you wonder if it's a bear and you know, fucking Sasquatch or some shit.
It's a good way to feel something.
Yeah. And then it was like, well, and you can't see, you don't know where you're running your water, but yet you know the fish are there and you get rewarded for it usually. But one of the things that I see that rewards people, the going to the unknown, is because you've caught a lot of 16, 18 inch little piss ants over here that are, they keep your ego going. They keep you driven. It's really hard to go out on the water and say, I'm just not going to catch anything today.
Right.
I mean, like you said, you got to have a lot of net time, a lot of fish in the net, and you got to be comfortable with wanting to learn and break some rules and, you know, figure it out yourself. So that's why I tell people, even if it's not a full day, just take a day. I mean, if you want to know why guides are great, it's because certain guides are really, really great. And certain guides are just putting in time. They're just, you know, they're just rowing the boat and not giving a shit. And then there's the guides of the superstar guys. And there are a couple things you find is one is on their days off, they fish. And before being a guide, they fish their asses off. And what they do is they don't have to go, my brain swirling around the Pier Marquette. When I started back then, there was like two or three of us on the river. And I'm no shit, there's probably 150 now. I don't know, it's crazy how many guides are down there. But there was always a standout guides. There was, in any fishery in the world, there's always been that standout guy. And it's because they work their ass off. They don't go fish the same run, you know, just going back in time, to, for example, the Premier Cat, and this is steelhead stuff. You wouldn't go into the Cove and just park up, or go to Waddell's, or go to Third Clay Bank and just lock your ass in there and think you've learned a goddamn thing. You haven't learned shit. You know you're catching fish there, but you're not learning. And the really great anglers and the great guides are people who experiment and explore. I'm thinking of Walt Grau, John Clusing guys, you know, guys that I fish with there that were just exceptional, great guides, Russ Madden. There was a lot of, I don't know, not a lot. I mean, if 10% is a pretty big, that would be a lot. And so when I tell people, if you would take a day, take a half day even, and just, you floated the, whatever river it is, I don't give a shit what river it is. If you go to your favorite run, you've never got a two-footer in there, just stop going there. Just go to the other side. Try something different. I mean, and with that, I think location's even more important. And I think if you trigger it, if it works right, if you got the even close to the right fly, it'll happen. But it'll never happen if the fish isn't in the freaking water. It can't happen if they're not there. This is not rocket science.
I mean, it's hugely important. I remember my first year out here, I was talking to Johnny about, you know, just like, I'm catching good fish and, you know, really solid fish, like we talked about, 20-inch fish, great fish. Mm-hmm. I got in a few of those, and I'm just going, you know, Johnny, why am I not finding bigger fish? He goes, well, I realized pretty quick, he's saying this about his time, if you want to catch big fish, you got to fish where big fish are.
Yeah.
And it's so simple. But like, you know, the Madison is an incredible river. Numbers, you know, your average size fish is great. It's not a trophy trout fishery. It's really rare to see a fish over 2 feet. I think our guides got, you know, two or three this year in how many guide days?
Yeah.
And they're good. They know where fish are, you know? So I think it's huge. You know, you got to fish where the fish are.
But in a little bit of... in defense of the guides for that, you also have very few people who want to trophy hunt.
Right. Yeah. You know, negating, most of the time they're not hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. But and we've had years where maybe six fish over 2 foot. But if you think about it, I'm just kind of jogging back through 25 years here, 24 years of. Johnny gets, you know, certain people have certain they want to go. But most people just want to have the rod bent, and that's the real difference.
Right.
That's the difference between any trophy hunter in the world. I mean, period, end of discussion. You have to be past that ego-driven, you know, I if I don't catch any fish today, everybody's going to say I suck. It's kind of like when we shoot the show, when we're out in the show and I get my ass kicked, and I know a dozen jackoffs are going to call in and say, you suck, I'm 10 times better than you. And I'm like, great, do a show, show me. I would love to, I'll take anything I can get info-wise, right? And so it comes down to like this hunt for the 30. Now, we're not too far into it. We still got, you know, we were hoping to shoot this in 10 days. Of course, you're hoping to pop a 30. It's like winning the freaking lotto. But, and now it's winter and it's freezing. And so now we got a whole new set of circumstances. The likelihood of us even having a shot at it are pretty minimal. One that's just hostile out there right now.
It's 6 degrees on my drive in.
Oh, it sucked. I hate snow. I used to love it. And one of my biggest fish ever was in the brown trout, was this time of year. And it was a post-spawn fish, but it was freezing. It was, everything sucked, man. It was just, and it was the most uneventful thing on earth. Like a lot of giant browns, it wallowed around for a second and hit the bank. But it was a freaking monster, right? But anyway, I mean, it's just, back to that thing. It's just really, and there's a lot of hot shoe. You know, when I was growing up, there weren't guys your age that were great. There were, there were, we just didn't have the data. We didn't have all the information we've got now. But now you've got all these, I was talking about this with Andy when we did the podcast, and about just how many unbelievably great anglers there are that are under 25, 30 years old. Didn't exist when Chet and I were, my buddy Chet over in Laurel, we grew up together in Michigan. When we were fishing, you know, we'd both read the magazines and go out and we'd try shit. But, you know, we didn't get to fly around the world and do shit like that. We just had to go fish. We didn't care. We wanted to learn. The information highways filled it so fast now that now you've got these free-thinking young minds and old guys, too, and gals. I mean, there's plenty out there because, you know, some people are just driven. And now you're seeing people willing to push the envelope past the regular, right? Past just, we do this, this, and this. And they're like, yeah, well, that's what Gallup does. He's full of shit. Let's try this.
Right.
Right? And there's going to be the new, you know, the how we did this stuff when Russ and I and Bob and Jerry and those guys, when we were starting all this stuff about the speeds and the different, and bigger flies and more of this, more of that into it. That was really radical shit. But right. We were also, you know, I was in my 40s, but Russ was in his 30s. And you know, there were a lot of elements that had not been done. It's just it's amazing that, it, you know, that stuff had just not been tried. And it was kind of like, I always talk about Roland Martin. He's a bass guy, one of the greatest in history. And he was like the first guy to like break down zones, and we fish in this depths and these depths at this time and that day. And he just kind of synchronized things. And I was always so fascinated that before that, we just went fishing, right? And it's about even in the tournament stuff. And so it's in its infancy. And now with the information highway and these kids coming along and they're free thinkers, things will change. But the one thing that won't change is there aren't going to be that many 30s.
Right.
It's just,
yeah.
It's, you, man, everything has to be right. Everything, notwithstanding landing the damn thing. I mean, I don't care. They're generally giant browns aren't that spectacular fighters. Matter of fact, I've never had a great. My biggest one ever took me a long time simply because I was by myself in my jet sled and I couldn't net the damn thing. I had him in the boat and I'll bet you 2 minutes. And I'd walk to the front of the boat and I had my big Chinook net and I'm like, you know, shit, I can't do it. And I'd run to the back of the boat. I wish I had it on video. It was such a cluster. It was a disaster. It took me easily 15 to 20 minutes to get the goddamn thing. And I'm beside it. I'm right. Closer than you
it's,
and I
it's
are.
It's not a great fighter. It's just fat. It has a lot of weight.
I go like this. It's huge. I mean, this thing was like this long. It's a big, I told Andy, it didn't count. It was a spawner. I was fishing steelhead, actually, wasn't he? And so I'm not targeting the brown. When I found, say, I found there's a shit ton of them there, I started targeting them. It was a run full of steelhead and browns. Yeah. And an occasional Chinook and coho, actually. Because I got a coho that day, I think, or a Chinook that day also. But it was anyway. Right? I get it to the boat, and I'm like this, and you can only hold so much, and you're pulling, and you're... And then you put that net in the water. Well, the net's freaking huge, right? So it goes like this.
Right.
It was a cluster. It was just—it was the most ridiculous thing. I actually pulled it up to the top and dropped my rod and took two hands and scooped the fish. It was like I need to do something. I just got lucky that I put it in the net. But it was a shitty fight, like most of them are.
Yeah.
And so, and I got lucky that it's very well hooked. So a lot of shit goes wrong. A fish that heavy, you know, you pull out, you can, you know, line, all kind of shit happens.
Like that fish behind you, they can have that big mouth gap in the bucks, and it's hard to hook them in the first place, even if you can
this
get
one
to eat.
Yeah, look at the teeth in that thing. Yeah. I didn't catch that fish, by the way. I mounted it for the Nationals. John Klusing caught that fish. One of the superstar guides, and now his kids, and there's a bunch of those guys back there, that kids are now like, that's what I keep waiting to see, because you see that a lot. You see the guys like, any of those guys. There's guys over on the Horn, I know that a lot of the steelhead guys are second, third generation shit, right?
Right.
brains are just rolling. It's like so cool. You know, everybody wants to sit, like, you know, back when Lefty and I were doing seminars the last couple of years before he died, and everybody said, oh, it must have been great. I said, I don't want to talk to Lefty. I mean, I want to talk to Lefty's grandkid. Right. Yeah. I've heard everything Lefty had to say, or whoever. I've read everything that the Brookses did, whatever. I want to hear what their kids, or maybe their kids, say.
I mean, it makes sense, right? Things. It's like, you know, I think of, you know, yourself, and like John Stenerson's a great example, right? Where
his Parker?
Yeah, game warden. Like, well, no, yeah. Even Stenerson's dad, right? Like, yeah. He game grew warden. Up in it. You know, he
was immersed.
An outstanding angler from a very young age.
Yeah.
And with the brain plasticity of a child being able to absorb, you know, basically everything dad's learned.
Yeah.
And then just, you know, he starts building on it at 12 or 13. And then has
12 or 13. He's like
a incredible
savant.
Right? Yeah,
I hate that kid.
Yeah,
he's so good. And he, but exactly that. There he is, you know. And it's like, I just love that part. We just shot a Fly Fish TV episode of Parker, and he's, I can't remember. He's 10, 12. He wasn't much older than that if he was. And he's a spay guy, right? And so, and we go fishing. We're on the salmon. He says. And the whole setup was, we're going to feature Parker showing me how to spay fish. You know, I'd spay fish, I'd cast a little bit. And with Walt Grouse, started me with all that way back in late 80s, early 90s. And I just didn't do it much. And I thought, what a great show, right? But we didn't really anticipate what would happen. Parker comes up, I think it's the first, we're on this run, Gene's filming him. And he goes, well, you know, I just need to cross this, you know. Throw it out, set your line, and boom! He goes, see? It's not that hard. You shitting me? Little prick.
Cocky little bastard, huh?
He wins. Yeah. Now he's like taller than John and way better. But again, exactly what you said. This, it's, you know, it's kind of fun trying to be the guy who's got all the answers, but nobody does. And there's a lot to learn. And it's and that was one of the keys with Russ. When Russ Madden and I did so much in that early days, the research, and his mind, well, his mind's a little messed up anyway, but he thinks in other realms out there, you know, right, where right. He comes up with some of the shit he comes up with, but it always works. But he was that generation, he was that free-thinking kid, right? And I'm still a little, you get a little trapped in your mind. You get a little trapped. I mean, it's like, I just keep thinking about Andy, because we had so many questions that we asked each other back and forth. You know, most award-winning angler ever in the tarpon world. And it was just mind-blowing to him that we have all these flies and colors and shapes and sizes and stall flies and accelerators and different things that go on. And it was, you know, and you could see his son, Nicky, he's just, it's just, I saw this great meme. Is that when you see those things on the computer shit?
Meme.
And I saw it, told Mel, I said, you know, you don't get, I was watching the Tyson fight, and, you know, I loved watching Mike fight forever. And I said, you know, the world wanted to see Tyson win because it'd be one for the old guys. And I told Mel, I says, there's no such thing. Nature cures all that shit, right? And I was watching that, and wasn't the old Mike, right? And I said, you know, at some point you got to realize that that was a great era of your life, and you got to move forward,
right.
And maybe you think more and get punched less. But the meme was two bricks. I'm talking about Nicky Milt, you know, Andy's son, who's a guide in Colorado and probably a great guide. I would assume. But the meme is two bricks. And I'm sure you and Johnny would love to show me this, so I didn't tell you. And it's water pouring in, and it says information. It's water pouring in, and that there's a brick, and the shit's flying off of it, and there's a sponge, and it's sucking all the information in. Sometimes you do something too long, maybe you get a little brickish, right? But I got you guys, which I've been blessed to have all, you know, these young, great anglers, Johnny and, you know, Jeremy and all the guys that worked here, and they're a sponge, you know, they're resource suckers. They're just sucking everything they can out of you. It's like, I need more answers, right? And it's like, well, there aren't any more. But they took all that shit in. Because I used to, you know, in the old days, like when people would say, I want to guide with you. I said, no, you want to go Johnny. Right. He's taller, better looking, and smarter. His reflexes are better, and he's not pissed off at the world. So the five things that you want out of a guide, he still is, right? And so, and he says, I would hope after, back then it'd be 10 or 15 years, I said, Johnny knows everything I know, and I would hope if you're a worthwhile teacher that that student goes past you.
Right.
Because that's what stalls anglers. When you think you know everything and you stop listening and you, or you're the brick instead of the f-ing sponge.
Right.
You know, listen. You guys.
I know it all, the ego.
Yeah. I did that 20 years ago. And you may have. But so what have we done? Is that it? Is it over? Hell no. I mean,
you can always do better, right?
Yeah. And there's always one more thing. Like you say, oh man, I went there and it didn't work. So I popped one over here and I did that. Boom. And it's, you got one. It's, no, I got three.
Right.
Okay. Getting a fish doesn't mean shit. Getting multiple fish means shit.
It's a pattern.
Once you can replicate something, anybody can have a lucky, you know.
Yeah.
Our buddy Jake wanted me to teach him how to do a spinning back fist or something. I don't remember what it was. I said, you going to do that a lot? I said, you know, you need to get in the ring with somebody and have them do that three or four times. When you can do it twice, then you'll be great.
Right.
I said, but hitting that heavy bag ain't really doing it. We don't have repercussions like that in the fishing world. We don't get punched back. So, but it's like that where you, if you could do any replication, and that was the big thing about kind of like when we read the comments and the dumbasses when they comment in the videos, like it's like, oh, I've done that too. Great. How did you do it?
Good for you.
Now let's see the third fish.
Right.
When you show the third fish, when you get the third over 25, that's when I'm...
Then you might have a system.
Yeah, yeah. That's when... And what is your system, right? And so youth, the young anglers, which, you know, even at Johnny's age, what is he, 42 now, one or two? I mean, but 20 years of absolute insane fishing. I mean, people say they fish a lot. You know, Johnny, I guarantee you, if you call water, because a guide's on the water. And I said that earlier about the great, you know, what makes a guy great is time on the water. And when I talk about designing flies, I don't design it for me. I know what I can do with the fly. I understand stalling and I understand accelerating in certain zones and not just pulling the rope. And so, but I also guided most of my life and I know what it takes. I need to know what you can do with the fly.
Right.
And so I watch what you do with the fly. And so as a guide, and you know, you're living vicariously through your client in some respects because you're trying to teach them to do what you do. And especially guides like Johnny, who's such a great big fish hunter, most of his clients want to do that, right? And so now he gets to learn, and I had a big, big amount of, I mean, large number of guys who like Herm Thomas and who, you know Herm comes out still, Herm, and 30 years ago, who would do anything I asked him to, or Jerry Dennis or Big Jerry or guys like that. It's just, you know, do this, try that, do this. And there was a lot of guys like that that were like, they were my guinea pigs.
Right.
And so then you take a Johnny who's got that same thing and they just keep taking all that info they see. And so Johnny's on the river, what, 150 days a year, I think, or so. But he's another 100 days by himself. Johnny's one of those guys like, I tell all my guides, you've heard it 100 times, I start watching my guides on their third year. They're all great the first year, the second year. The day I see the third year guide who drinks more than they fish, they're out of our jail. They're gone. Because now you got a career drunk who doesn't fish anymore, who just wants to, you know, it's a job all of a sudden. And they lose their desire to get great. And I go back and I look at some of the guys that I was talking about. you know, back in Michigan where I did most of my guiding. I mean, I guided here too for 10 years, but not like I did back there. And these guys that were so influential and so driven, you know, the Rays and Ray Schmitz and Jack Ford. Shit, Jack Ford's 85, I think. Now, Smith's still out rowing that boat. I'll bet he still rows 100 days, right?
Yeah.
Driven for an answer.
Right.
That probably you don't ever get, but every, and, you know, Ray Schmitz, I just saw a thing with Ray a couple days ago, and it was like, these guys are all 10 years older than me, or some a little bit more, still driven. Walt Grau, John Klusing, you know, just these guys that are, they're never seek. Dave Ellis, the best ever. Dave's the best angler I've ever known in my life. Period, end discussion, and probably the best tire I've ever known as far as, you know, functional thinking of a design of a fly. Dave's 85, and I don't care what it is. Like, he came out and fished with me 2 years ago or three, and we went on the lake and kind of got our ass kicked. Had a great spinner fall going, little Calabatus. And Dave looked at every fly, and by the next year, and he gave him, I got all the flies. Every one of them's perfect. And all he did is immerse himself, found every article and everything he could find on fly tying for these flies and why and how he did it. And all of a sudden, it's like everything in there is perfect. And we should do this and this and this and that. And he's asking questions. And that's the thing. He asked questions at 85. Best angler I've ever known in my life. So goddamn intimidating to fish with him. It is. I've had two or three guides that fished with him on the Bighorn when Mike, when he went to stay with Mike Craig, and, you know, when he first started fishing out there, and they would call me and say, "Holy shit, who is this guy?" I said, "He's Mr. Intimidation." No shit, dude. You look at his boxes. He's just got all these freaky thought out process because he keeps asking the question. Long way around the barn on that was the fact that I enjoy listening to the Sponge and the Brick and the Your Age and the Parker Stenerson kids, and now you see them walking in that door and they ask questions, man.
Right.
They don't say, what color do we take?
What are they biting on?
Yeah, what are they biting on? A good drift. And so they ask questions.
Okay, so circling back, I want to ask a question of, you know, if you're looking to hunt a 30-inch fish, what are the things you can do to improve your odds? And from what we've talked about so far, I think that curiosity and, you know, being a sponge, absorbing knowledge that's already out there, mm-hmm. are two of the biggest things. It's, I think, part of hunting a 30 is a mindset, right? Of you.
It's a dedication.
You want to be great, right? And it's not being complacent with where you're at or what you know. It's a constant, you know,
this is a memory for me. I want to do something.
It's constantly trying to improve. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other points that we've kind of discussed are, well, you got to be where the fish are. That's mm-hmm. important. Be in systems that have 30 inch fish.
I think, you know, we didn't say that. That's a good point. You just said not every system. We did kind of kick the ball around the outfield there with the, this isn't like the Madison. This is, even though there's a high 20s, low 30s fish on the wall that we found dead in this river, obviously came out of Quake Lake.
Right.
But there are systems that just have very few big fish in them. That's definitely a case. So, and it's no different than anything. You know, I talked about my cousin Billy hunting in the same, where we were born, and I was in Chase, Michigan. It's just not a big whitetail. You got nice 8-10 points, you know, now and then, but a lot of scrubby little shit. It's not an Ohio or Missouri bucks. It's not that. It's not, you want to catch a really big fish, you have to go where they live. And, you know, that's, I don't know if we hit on that, but it's really important that just because you fish a certain river and it's, you know, there's a lot of fish that have, there's a lot of rivers that produce much bigger fish than others, and nutrient values and pH, everything else that goes into making big fish, or, you know, so you really, that's really important. It really is. Doesn't mean that you don't have a chance in almost any river.
Right.
Because virtually every river, or that fact, cricks this wide. I have seen fish in the, you know, high 20s dead in cricks that were, what is, yeah, what
the
is
the size
this?
Of water has almost yeah. nothing to do Why with is how it? Big the fish yeah. are.
It's just, yeah. it's just where they live. And so I digress.
I think, you know, if like, if you want to see a 1400 pound grizzly bear, yeah. you go to Kodiak Island.
Yeah.
They're not anywhere else. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So and
you got to be in the right
reason.
Environment where they can grow to that size. Mm-hmm. And I think you hit on something huge, the size of water has almost nothing to do with mm-mm. it. You know, we generally fish larger water because I think, you know, you yourself, I know Johnny has an affinity for large water. I love giant fish in small water. Feels manageable, more hopeful for me. Mm-hmm. But without, you know, naming specific rivers, what would some advice be for somebody who's trying to find systems that have 30-inch fish in them? What would steps be, you know, if you're going to recommend kind of the process to an average angler, where would you start?
Well, the internet is out there and that's huge. And so, you know, historically speaking, the rumor mill's always the rumor mill. It's just about a billion times bigger now with the yep. internet. And so you see posted fish. I mean, I hate that when people, that is just so to me, such a rookie move. Just so, you're such a freaking bush leaguer when you ask. You don't ask that. You don't ask people where they catch their fish. You ask, you know, if it's a buddy, I suppose, but you should earn your fish. That's something, we hear it on this shit on our videos. Oh, where'd you get that one? Well, I caught it underneath the log, 600 yards below the bridge here on the left, and throw it to the left, right? Earn your damn fish. But the internet's out there, and you can see. I mean, it's not a mystery. You know the White and the Holston and the Missouri and the Yellowstone and the Big Manistee in Michigan and the Farmington and out east. I mean, you know big fish rivers. They're there. Although when you only go to those, you preclude a lot of those tribs that can hold some massive fish too. That's when it's, you know, you do your homework and you start doing that. Russ Madden was great at that, where he would just go fish the dumbest shit you ever heard of.
Yeah, they call it blue lining.
Yeah.
Right? Find a blue line on a map and go fish.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And it's, you know, it could be a waste of a day, but so many places to start along with your local fly shop, right? Go talk to them.
Yeah, just do it. Pose the question in a reasonable manner. There's a lot of dumbass. I mean, you just walk in, you don't know anybody, you got no relationship, and you ask them where you got the biggest fish of your life was. Oh, right here. Here's a map. You know, maps. I hate that. It's earn your fish. And really, in reality, people that do that they're not much of a threat anyway. But the first thing I would do is make sure, and identifying the rivers is simple. It doesn't. I mean, some of my favorite. One time, I got stuck. Somebody beat me to my run once and pissed me off. He kind of tracked me, and he beat me to where I was going, and so I had to go somewhere else. And lo and behold, that was my favorite new run. My favorite new spot, right? And I got rewarded. I thought it was a, you know, fish god thing. I got a really big fish, a lot bigger than I'd ever caught in the other room, where I just kind of seemed to. It's a after work, after, you know, just I get an hour to go fish somewhere. It was back in Michigan. And I just went, I got into a rut. And I went and I
Comfort
found my
zone.
Next, yeah, and I found yeah. my next favorite spot, better than the other one. And so, but it's, I don't know, you know, it kind of just, running around the circle there, but it's just basically at this point there's enough information out there. Like, I like to go fish tailwaters that I've never heard of anybody fishing, and in particular for brown trout, ones that they say where the water's not that great for not that many fish in them.
Right.
When you tailwaters are tailwaters, and there's several within 100 miles of here that I've never seen an angler on.
Right.
And don't get to go to them, you know, and you're limited to numbers. But when you have limited numbers, you generally have bigger fish. You know,
why that is?
No. Maybe I don't have any clue why. And it may just be that they're limited numbers for maybe, and it takes the pressure off and they grow. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to be, I used to fish a river in Michigan behind a dam, and it was just absolutely, but it was 100 yards of water, 300 at best in the margin, 200 peripheral marginal zones that were just not so great. But when people found out about it, they ruined it. And then second, you know, it's just like, well, first of all, they keep them. They would keep them, right? That puts a damper.
Hard to catch them again.
Yeah, when you got 20 fish in 100 yards, it's kind of hard if they kill every one of them. And, you know, they did. And so the recruitments, you know, to get a really, to get a 30-inch fish, you know, to get a 30-inch male brown is so hard to do if it's not a lake fish. Because, you know, brown trout, you're that fish on the wall. I have to take a picture of that thing that we found dead. Your giants and your world records are post spawn females. They once they're done spawning, which you know that can be anywhere 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. They just quit spawning and they just eat. Right. I told my girlfriend Mel this once. I said, you know, brown trout are a lot like women. Not the smartest thing I ever said.
Doghouse.
And when I woke up from that frying pan, it's a joke. I was, don't write in and tell me what an asshole I am. I already know it. but the giants are the post-spawn females, and they just continue to eat, but they don't go through the stress of the spawning vigors, you know, and the males, like all of us, we'll spawn until we die, right? We will just go fight the male. I mean, you go into a bar, there's one gal in the bar and there's 10 drunk cowboys, and we'll wait and fight it out for who gets the shot, and, you know, and that's what browns do. And that's what, big elk do it. Big whitetails do it. All animals do it. They're just nature. They're driven by that drive to reproduce. And so the browns, and you'll see massive browns just beat to living shit in December, right? They're coming down with the scars all up and down their backs, and their tails are chewed and everything. They've just been biting. I mean, out back, there's a male out there that's been there for 3 weeks right now. Yeah. He's freaking huge. Dude, he's a monster. And he's just, I don't know how he's alive. And if you fish around in December, that's when you find these big dead browns, and they're always males. They just, and big dead elk, you know.
Well, I sent you a picture of one that I found. It's 28 and a half. It was, you know, in its last stages of life. It was dying. It was floating sideways. It was all moldy and scarred up. And I sent you the photo and said, you know, what happened to this fish? And he said, well, man, he went out on top with a cigarette in his mouth.
Pretty much. He's like, he ran it to the end. It's over. And so, I don't know where we're going with that, but it's...
Yeah,
back
big,
on
big
how to
females. Yeah.
Well, the big females, that's where you're going to see. But the brown, the males, it's hard. That's one of the other reasons that it's hard to get that 30. Is it that you want the big buck male, right? They just get the big, it's just cool. It's just cool looking. Yeah. Look at that badass head. I mean, look at that freaking head on that thing, right?
It's just a mean bastard.
Yeah. And so, but your question was, well, how do we start it? Right? How do we get to the rivers? And that one's just time spent. I mean, shit, you can look up anything on the internet now and find rivers and just go fish them. But then you got to be, like we said earlier, where the fish are. So run me the question again, because I kind of...
So in talking of kind of how to hunt a 30-inch fish, what are the things you can do to improve your chances? And we talked about now, you got to be where the fish are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, your whole streamer theory, everybody knows you as a streamer guy, even though you've done a lot more than that in the fishing world. Your streamer theory, your streamer system, I think is the best way I've seen to actively hunt these large fish, being active retrieves, you know, reaction and food-based bites. It's, to me, it's a simple calorie equation. You know, those big fish generally stop eating midges at some point. You know, everybody has caught a giant fish on something small, but So I think, you know, talk a little preface, bit about the, you know, the
circle what a giant fish is too.
Right, right. But talk a little bit about the strategies that can improve your odds of targeting these big fish.
Well, there's a ton to it, because all predators are the same, and all predators are nocturnal. And actually, other than us, almost everything's nocturnal, really. Anything with canines, anything that eats shit is nocturnal. And so now, like I said, withstanding going night fishing all the time, but because that's just a whole different realm, that's a different deal. But and they're much more active. But so your day fish, I mean, the things that can turn it for you, first and foremost, you have to be where the fish are. Your fly has to be near the fish to do it. But realizing that at least, I'm just pulling this out of my ass, really, half of them, say, maybe a third of them, aren't going to eat. Right. Period, end of discussion, you know? And you realize that a brown trout or a rainbow trout or a brook trout, I don't give a shit, all the trout, if you realize that they will try to eat when they become predaceous, when they become huge, and that's somewhere around 22 inches is when they, 24 maybe, where they pretty much become predaceous and they only eat meat. They well, like I said, I've been a taxidermist forever, right? And so, like, John's brown there, as a spawner, that's a Lake Michigan fish, but I've been able to look in the bellies of just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of giant fish. And to find a bug in one is like, even growing up in Michigan, where we fished a lot of night fish, right? And that was to see a bug, other than the biomass of a hexhatch, which is the biggest mayfly in the world, other than that, was almost non-existent. And most of the big fish that I mounted for people were gear guys running stuff, you know, and bait guys, and you just didn't see them. It just wasn't a thing. And so knowing that the fish is probably full, it's going to take a lot of the fish out of the equation, right? So now it becomes a mathematical equation. How many times can you put a fly, the right kind of fly, in the right zone and do everything right? Don't have your head up your ass and, you know, throw it out and the thing's floating and you're like, what'd you say? Oh, I don't know if the Lions won last night or not. I don't know. What? Seahawks? Never heard of them. And that kind of shit. It's a mathematical equation.
It's all odds.
It is odds.
Just trying to improve your
odds. You know, I remember one of our guides, Dougie Pauline, mentioning that, you know, he had all these theories about exponential loss after X seconds of fighting a fish. And it, really, when you listen to it, it was pretty accurate. Over 60 seconds, your chances for a loss just grow exponentially, like every 20. And because there's just shit happening, right? You're tearing the fly out, the line's getting
it's
hit.
Rolling.
Yeah, there's a million
rocks,
things that can go
logs,
wrong.
Everything.
Yeah. And so, and it's the same thing when you go down the river. And so you got to put the math in your favor. You're a good caster. You can read water. I think reading water is the most important thing in all of fishing, and probably the thing done most poorly of all angling. We don't really talk about water as much as we do fishing, and everybody wants the secret fly and the right retrieve. But water's it, right? There, and, you know, we've said it over and over. The fish are where they are. If you don't put your fly where the fish is, and if you don't do it right, and you don't retrieve it properly, your odds just keep, you know, they just keep going down. And so reading water and understanding that big fish are generally not on the treadmill where the, I'll just put it, 18 to 22 are great fish. They are not trophies for what we're talking about.
Right.
They are spectacular fish, but they are not trophies. You got to get that 2 foot and above mentality when you start playing that trophy game. And I don't give a shit where you're fishing. It's still, that's that. And so, and once they become that trophy, they are no longer day feeders. They are not, They put very little emphasis on the day, the bugs and the hat. It happens. Everybody's caught one. I mean, I have, you have, everybody has. Replication, replication. Make it happen three times in a row. Then we're all good and listening. And so so you have to have the fish where they belong. You have to have everything go right. And so that part's there. And then you have to have some sort of process that makes things different than just hucking and hoping.
Right.
And so you know where your fish are, you're experimenting, and you did see. And I grabbed this paddle tail soft plastic because one of the things that I did all my life, and still to this day, I still do, and I fish alone probably 85% of the time. I go to new systems, and that's how I learned about steelhead in the fall. We didn't know in Michigan that we had fall steelhead so much. This is because it's a pretty new fishery, even though they've been in there for 100 years. But we just knew they were there in the spring, and that's really a 60s thing. But to figure it out, we would throw spinners in the river. Tom Noms was the first one. Tom was a great angler, a guide. Taught me a ton. And Tom used to throw, he didn't care, he'd fish anything, just like we all did in the old days. In the old days, it wasn't this fly-only thing.
Right.
I fished bait, I still do. I go back, Jerry and I fish spawn bags, I don't give a shit, I'll fish a night crawl. I do not care, I'm still letting them go, I'm still, you know. But I've done two shows with Bill Erdman, who's one of the greatest gear anglers I've ever known in my life. Bill and I go fish all over, and he's always running giant crankbaits. He's running, you know, 8, 9, 12 inch countdown, big wraps, everything. I mean, just giant food sources, right? And I see how fish respond to him. I do it, done it all my life. Like I said, I did it in Michigan in the 70s and 80s, trying to identify where fish were. And when I started doing the streamer thing, I also did it. That doesn't come up very often in conversation, because when I was guiding, I can't do that, right? I probably could have. I didn't ask back then.
And you're saying throwing gear.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And I particularly like soft plastics weren't that big of a deal back then. Swim baits, glide baits now, anything, stalling baits, things that I can make do funky shit. Jigs have always been just meant. But I would go and I would frequently do it without hooks. Right, because I would try to identify where a fish was with a big. I fished, and I didn't talk about that much, because back in the day, if you weren't a fly only guy, you were like the Antichrist and you were a piece of shit. But I never really bought into that stuff. I still don't. I think we so stun our learning by just thinking fly, and you like when. Well, you fished with Bill. He's an incredible angler. I don't know if you ever fished him. Bill.
I did.
Yeah, you fished him.
Yeah.
And I mean, thinking trophy his whole life. And I mean, if he's not hunting big fish, he's hunting big animals, right? And that mindset sets in. And so I did a lot of that when I was by myself. Or I'd just go out and walk. And I would throw, I'd thrown it a countdown. I think it was an 8 that I used to throw a lot, 6 or 8 inch basically long. I loved jigging. And so I would do that a lot. And I would just see them. But I didn't have hooks on them a lot of times. Just right. See them bash them.
Just then, to see where they are in the system.
Exactly.
Right?
Same way we learned steelhead in the fall, where they would lay up and sit up, because all we'd ever really seen in the 60s was that they were on the beds. Well, and it wasn't until really the 70s, the salmon came back in 68, so nobody was fishing back. And we didn't have extended seasons. There was a lot of shit didn't go our way to learn shit. You didn't have extended seasons, and then you did for steelhead, and then you had them on certain rivers, not others. And it's just as of late that this shit about year-round, I don't like this year-round fisheries. I really wish we had seasons, or at least sections. It would be... I think it was better, but that's a sidebar. But anyway, you're back to this whole having the right stuff and knowing where the fish are. And so then you got this mathematical equation. You're trying to put the right fly in the right place. And so I think in front of fly, first and foremost is reading water. So softer water, you know, the fish are going to be on the...
When you say soft water, what do you mean?
Not much push to the water. And when I do my video or my seminars, I tell people, if you stand in water, I don't know if you can't see my legs, but if you stand in water and it pushes you around like that,
it's too fast.
Too fast. They're just there for the couch, you know?
I talk about, you know, I was just down steelheading with Matt and Chris, and we talked a lot about broken water versus unbroken water.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there can be water that appears to be fast, but it's broken. There's structure down low that is creating, you know, places for fish to lie. Versus there water that's seemingly slow, but if it's unbroken, if it's kind of a gravel sidewalk down below, it's not a great fish habitat because, you know, what I always said when I was talking to people about kind of where fish sit, you got to look for the couch in the middle of all the treadmills. Mm-hmm. A big fish is a lazy fat person. So think of them like that. And where are they going to be? I think what was revolutionary for me when I came out here and started fishing with you all, you know, I'd heard you say fish where other people walk, all of these things. And it's so hard to believe until you actually see it. I mean, one of the biggest brown trout I've ever caught came out of a foot and a half of water in an undercut, maybe less than a foot and a half. It's probably a foot of water. And like, I never would have fished that before. I know that your rules are generally, what, a foot and a half to 3 feet, 3.5 feet, something like
that. Well, when I was diving, I always refer to that because that was visual. And you know, one of the things people always, we get it every once a week, somebody calls, well, I want a line that can get me into the really deep stuff where the big browns are. And I don't believe that I don't really think, I say it in every seminar, there's no always or no never. There is never... and always, ever, never, you don't get these. Nothing never happens, nothing always happens. And so they break every rule.
Yep.
I mean, it's just the way...
I think especially lake fish, too, can break those rules.
Yeah, well, they're just there for a different reason. They're really short-term. But when you say lake fish, you mean migratory fish.
Yeah, migratory fish.
They're breaking rules because they're just holding up and waiting to screw. And so, but... the big fish in my diving, almost all the really huge fish I saw were in less than 3 foot of water. And I don't recall.
Slow, broken water.
Almost always on the inside. Water, and when you found them in the middles, it was always on these big mid-river flats where you can, the rivers, that's what I said, people don't read water well at all. The water's going all, and then you'll see this thing in the middle that is the couch. There's this, the water's everywhere and nobody's fishing it. And there'll be something, a boulder field, a stump sticking up, or just a mound of some shit, I don't know, whatever. It just all of a sudden there's this soft spot. And it's very, almost always really short, like less than 20 feet, right? And it's like, that's the person who identifies the really, that's premium. But most of the stuff has been on an inside bend. And again, I'm qualifying this at not that 18 to 22 world, which is fun as shit, but it's not a trophy. And so you get in there and you find these fish almost exclusively, no structure. Color changes are my favorite, parallel color changes, where the water's slow on one side and a little faster. And it can be a ledge. It can be water that drops off just like this, and it has a color change simply by depth. It can be the same substrate. It can be the same bottom, but it drops from, you know, it's coming down like this, and all of a sudden it goes, makes a little ledge, and they'll sit right on that edge like that. And there's a break. It's darker underneath because the light penetration is less, and it's lighter here because the sand's usually a different color. The substrate's sand, or it's smaller gravel because nothing's pushed it away, right?
Right.
Because there's no current flow. And that's a big one, is when you read water, if you can look at it and say, why is it different color? Well, there's two speeds to the current. And one current is taking the other, all the shit away, and the other one's just kind of like, it was so easy in Michigan, that one picture of the Manistee that, where it's a big inside, man, there is just a color break. It is just sandy tan to brown with all this detritus and shit on the bottom of the river. And it is such a, and that's one of the curves where I saw one of the giants. I mean, I did a lot of diving and you don't see that many, but, and you know, you get to extrapolate what you want to believe out of it, I suppose. But growing up in Michigan with all the log jams, you know, it was a, that was a climax white pine forest and totally, totally clear cut. I mean, the entire state is a stump, right? Because there's so much river, so much water that they could move all that to the Great Lakes and ship them, right? You have a way to get, facilitate to get the lumber built, and you could get it out into the big, and they barge them out and they could do what they had to do. But so there's a lot of log jams and things in Michigan. And that's where you learn to fish at night. That's where you think the, you know, the big one lives. And the biggest light that flipped on in my head was I never saw anything in that. I saw them at night when they move up to the tailouts behind them. But swimming around in that shit and them freaking snakes, I hate those bastards. God, there's a lot of, to go out and dive, it's pretty eye-opening. Yeah. It really is. And it's a little, you know, but, like I said, I dove a lot. I actually started diving in the Great Lakes following smallmouth around with a spinning rod and a jointed Rapala. And I mean, Lake Michigan, where I grew up, in Acme and outside of Traverse City on the East Bay. And all summer, all I did was swim around and fish and, you know, all the time. And I just carry a spinning rod and mass snorkel and an onion bag. I'd pick up shit that people, even back then, people were pigs. They just throw shit out in the lake. I don't know. I found a Prell bottle once. Glass bottle, broken half. Why would you do that? But anyway, the diving was that you'd find these fish on the softer waters. And so that was the first, for me, the first real eye-opener was that, man, you'll be looking at these outside bends that are so freaking juicy. They are just full of shit that you're just saying, oh, they've got to be in there. And yet, not in there, right? It just, and you get your 18s and 20s and stuff, and it's still, and it's hard to go past it. It'd be nice if you could go down the, what you think is shitty looking water, and then go back up and, you know, teleport yourself back up here and fish the outside. I've got a picture of the eagle run on the Asabo, Blow Mayo, and I show this outside where I fished, I don't know how many days I think the most days I ever did in that run was 42 in a season, but never less than 30. And never got a big fish, and I got three fish in one season once I realized where those fish were on the inside, right where I eat lunch.
Right.
Every time.
So tying it back in.
Pause. Piss. Tying it back in.
Yeah, so tying all of that discussion kind of back into how to hunt these large fish. You know, you need to be in the right systems. You need to be fishing the right type of water, which I think, you know, we talked about soft water, inside bends, frog water, right? We mm-hmm. posted on Instagram about that recently. You know, there's so many fishing guides. There's so many really fishy people in this world that want to push right through frog water. Yeah, it's too slow. They're not going to be
there.
I think
I mentioned that is my favorite big fish water.
It's, I mean, I would have done the same thing before seeing you fish, you know, all these hours now. Like, they're there. It's a certain point.
It's the ultimate couchville.
It is the ultimate
it's
couch.
It's like hundreds of couches.
They don't have to move, right?
They don't have to do a thing.
It's almost zero calorie output for them. They just have to exist. And I think the, you know, the hard part about frog water is the mentality it takes to fish there, having never caught a fish in it. You know, for a more beginner angler.
Maybe because you never fished it.
Right, maybe because you never fished it. But it is, like, for me, it's a lot easier to fish water that I know as traditionally trouty Now I've broken that out of my head at this point, and I see water a lot differently after being around you for these few years. But I think that that's a hard thing for beginning anglers, is it feels like you're hitting your head against a wall. I mean, it's kind of the same reason I don't like fishing lakes. I'm starting to enjoy it more, but it's doesn't feel as active. And I think frog water is so easy to just walk past, but I guess it's our you know, plead to you, the viewer, like, fish the frog water.
Well,
they're there.
It's funny, while you were saying that, and I was listening, and I suddenly had this memory, and it was because all angling's angling, and I realized that I was trying to remember when I started fishing frog water, and I was remember running spinners over frog water on rivers before I wrote the book and things like that, while I was researching, if you will, you know, testing things. And one of the things that always struck me was I love pond fishing. I love beaver pond fishing. We don't have a lot of it. We got some out here, but, you know, and they're usually pretty small, right? They weren't really giant things. And you would strip bugs over the weed beds, and there would be, and these fish would come up and you'd see it, right?
See, that sounds exciting.
Oh, it was cool as shit, right? And again, trophies were different. I got a 20 once in a pond. I thought I was Joe Brooks for sure, right? And so then I was fishing, I believe it was on the Jordan River in Michigan, and I was fishing spinners. And I went over a weed bed, and same thing, and this big brown, you know, 20, come up and ate it. And it was a watercress bed. It was three watercress beds, two or three in a row. And that sunfish came out of that, and I mean, messed me up, man. And then I kind of went on pause for a while and didn't fish as much of it. And then I started fishing in a lower part of one of the rivers up there, and because I was getting drove out by so many anglers, and I started fishing just rivers, major tributaries, but in places where they said there were no fish. That was the beginning of my real light flicking on, whereas I was just fed up with too many boats, which, by the way, back then meant like two. I mean, that was like, God damn, this river's ruined. And I would just get drove further down the rivers. And it's a great story on how that really, and one of the things that was about one of the sections that they said, even in one of the books, says it's too warm and there's no fish there. But I met these two old guys in a bar, and I almost said the name of the bar, but then they know exactly where I was fishing. But the bar, and I asked, and it's just me and whoever I was with, and we stopped in this bar, and there's one truck out front. It's 6:30 at night, it's the middle of summer, 7:30 maybe. We're gonna stop and have a hamburger and a beer, and we go, and I see their boat out there, and they got you know, a little John boat type thing, or a little V-bottom, and I said, "You guys fishing?" We saw the rods hanging out, you know, and they're both in their 80s, right? Funnier than shit. And I said, "He goes, how'd you guys do? You know, we're shooting up the breeze." "Ah, nothing, them goddamn greasers." I go, "What's a greaser?" You know, them Germans, Browns. I go, "What?" I mean, "What?" "What do you mean?" So we got in the boat. There's a 5-pounder. There's a 5-pound and probably a 20-inch brown and a 5-pounder. They're gardening these things. They're going in a mulch. This is a trash fish to these two guys. And so then later, the same guys, I see him, I think it was next year, I don't remember. I think it was Jerry Dennis and I on this trip. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, I go, "You guys get it?" And I'd see him every after that, yeah. You know. And now they're, you know, and these guys are both World War II vets, and one guy was 80. Shit, you wouldn't know it, but look, I think he was 88. He was firing shit. And I said, you get any greasers? Nope, we got busted by Johnny Law. I go, what? He goes, that son of a bitch said that I couldn't use brook trout to fish. And he owned, he's got this huge chunk of land in Michigan. I mean, you don't have chunks like we've got out here, right? And he says, I went in my own goddamn creek, and you can't, it's private. It basically starts on his land and ends in the river. And he goes, I caught 5 brook trout. That's my limit. And I took the damn, but then they'd hook him on treble hooks, and they're fishing pike. They want pike. That's what they fish for. And he says, but they got caught for fishing their own. He goes, it's my goddamn trout. He's just pissed off. Yeah. He goes, what's he going to do? Throw an 88-year-old man in jail? You can kiss my ass. It's a hilarious story. But anyway, I don't remember where I was going on that. All of a sudden, but just going to these drainages that pushed me down further and further. And as you go down the rivers in virtually any trip, in the Madison, you get down the Madison, you get down to the really great fish water for the big fish, and there's a lot of weed beds. Yep. And I noticed that everywhere I went. The further I got, the warmer the water got, and the bigger the fish got. And I did it throwing a spinner across a weed bed, and that one didn't have a hookless. That one got it. And it came out like it's supposed to. Right. And then I started just thinking, you know, okay, I'm diving, I'm seeing the fish in the soft water, I'm here and I'm there. And then it became, oh my God. That was,
if one was
maybe
here,
the biggest epiphany in all the water reading I had.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe the total single biggest was that, shit, we just, every guide to shit, I watch them do it all the time, spin their boats around, start rowing it out. Gotta get out of this frog water. It's like, thank you. See the landing.
Okay, I want to pause briefly for a new segment that I want to call Shit You Should Buy From Us. What you got going over there?
My brain's not working. Sisbuff. Shit you should buy from us. Sisfaboo. Sisfaboo, is that how you would say it?
Yeah, Sisfaboo.
Got it.
Sisbuffoo. Yeah. I was wondering what stroke of genius was about to come out of you.
Today I'm going to introduce you to a new segment that we're going to be doing. It's called Sisfaboo, or otherwise known as Shit You Should Buy From Us. And I'm going to start it with the white fathead kitty. This is the barred top tail one. The days I like those better, but all white or this. But I just want to go over a couple things about this fly because, you know, it's kind of my job to sell flies. But I don't hype shit that I don't believe in. And this fly has been, for me, one of my top flies probably ever in history as far as turning really big fish or hooking big fish. There's a bunch of stuff about this fly that I want to go over. One, it's got a pretty broad head, right? It's a broad, water-moving head. It also allows you to feel the fly the whole time. You feel this thing. But one of the bigger things that I like about it, it's got the flash on the belly, and it's very flashy here. It's really white. I really dig white flies. I mean, they're easy to track. They're fun to fish. Man, you see them coming at it. And it's got a lot of the things in there. But the big thing for this is I particularly like flies that I can stall. And if you don't learn, you know, we talk a lot about when we were doing the podcast for the Hunt for the 20 about techniques and how you stall flies and accelerate flies. I've always preached, don't just be the person that pulls the rope, right? Initiate the fly. You're the one that should be swimming your fly. And one of my favorite things that I do when I'm fishing is I'll read structure and I'll see a spot where something's like, especially a bank that's going to drop off and there's boulders up here and I'm coming out of shallow and I'm going to come over a ledge. I like to come burning over that thing with my fly, just going chow, 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 chow like this, right? Just cutting back and forth and getting a lot of action and stall it. Right? So the fly comes over, it's going crazy over here, poof, and it stalls. And this big rudder tail, right, this big American hackle tail, as it comes over, it's not going to drop like this. It's the tail is not, because you're initiating the action here. You're pulling it. The tail's not going to do this because the current is pushing the fly. So when you come over, you're ripping ass, and all of a sudden it stops like it got a cramp or something. It's like, oh, shit, here I am. I'm getting dying. And it comes over and it stalls. The tail's still going to turn. It's going to go like this. And you're going to get this big lazy ass thing. It's going like crazy, and all of a sudden it just slows down and it gets this lazy curve. And wham, 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 you start all over again. If stalling flies, to me, is one of the most important things that you can do while you're angling to trigger a response out of a fish. And so with this fly, I get a lot of that action. It's not so giant that it's hard for people to cast. It's got virtually no weight in it. It's got lead eyes, but it's only to counteract the, so it doesn't sit like that. It basically is just a neutral buoyancy. It sits like this because the hair carries so much air in it to stop it from going down. So this would be on the hunt for a 30 or a hunt for just a trophy. This is one of my all-time favorites. So in today's SysFabu, it's the Fathead Kitty, and particularly in white.
Okay, I think that is a great place to wrap up our first iteration of the Slide-In podcast. Once again, we're looking for names. So please throw it down in the comments, like and subscribe and all that good stuff. We hope you enjoy it. We're going to do a part two on kind of how to hunt 30-inch fish. You know, today we covered a couple of things. You know, you got to do everything you can to improve your odds. And two of the biggest parts of that is you need to be in systems where those fish are, and you need to be in the parts of those systems where those fish live. I think in part two, we should cover tactics, you know, all the different things that we can do to increase our odds once we know that we're in the right systems and we think we're fishing the right water. So come back for part two. Got any closing words?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.